at all. We had newspapers on the wall. It was air conditioned in the winter time. It was just a humble hut, but its door was never shut, and a man could get inside without a dime. Don't let them tear that little brown building down. Don't let them tear that precious building down. Don't let them tear that dear old.
If you or your organization would like to exhibit at this year's Full Circle Fair, we urge you to contact WERU today and ask for a vendor or exhibitor space application. Thousands of people will be on the Blue Hill Fairgrounds from 12 to 9 p.m. on Saturday, July 22nd, and from 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. on Sunday, July 23rd. You can exhibit in livestock stalls, under tents, or outdoors. Water and electricity are available at the fairgrounds. To get your exhibitor or vendor application, log on to weru.org and download one, or call 469-6600 during weekday business hours. You would really be helping community radio by returning your application as soon as possible. We will see you at the Full Circle Fair in Blue Hill this July 22nd and 23rd.
Is full of spectacular musicians, and we're lucky to live in an area where so many pass through. Some we've heard of before, some maybe not. Michael Galazian will be around for a show at the Unity Center for the Performing Arts this coming Friday, the 19th, and on Tuesday, he'll be joining us on the wing during the noon hour. Want to hear some spectacular acoustic guitar? If you like Leo Kottke or Michael Hedges, do yourself a favor and get to know Michael Galazian this Tuesday at noon.
Support for WERU comes from Maine Boats, Homes, and Harbors magazine, covering Maine's boats, harbors, arts, and architecture since 1987. Bringing the coast as close as the mailbox, on the web at maineboats.com.
You're tuned to WERU FM 89.9 Blue Hill, 102.9 Bangor, and streaming online at weru.org. Indigenous Voices with Rhonda Fry and Meredith DeFrancesco is next.
Welcome to Indigenous Voices, a monthly talk show discussing topics affecting the Native people of Maine. Today, May 16, 2006, we're discussing the restoration of the Penobscot River and its effect on the Penobscot tribe and the environment. I'm Meredith DeFrancesco.
And I'm Rhonda Fry. We are fortunate today to have with us John Banks, the Director of the Natural Resources Department at the Penobscot Indian Nation, Scott Hall, Manager of the Environmental Services for the PPL, and Laura Rose Day, Director of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust. Since creation, the river has always been the lifeline of the Penobscot people. But for the last 100 years, when the dams were built, it took land and other natural resources, including blocking the migration of the fish that were important for survival. Now, there's an extensive project to tear down some of the dams and to help restore the fish population and the tribal fishing rights. John, I'd like to begin with you. Could you tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and the tribe's historical use of the river?
Sure. Well, I'm the Natural Resources Director for the tribe, and I've been in that position since 1980. That includes the forestry program, fish and wildlife, water resources, and air quality. And we have an integrated natural resources program. As you said, we view the river as a living entity that's responsible for the tribe's well-being historically. We've used the river for thousands of years to meet all of our needs, physically and spiritually.
Can you elaborate on that a little bit more? Sustenance fishing was something that was there for some time, and then with the coming of the dams, that was interrupted.
Yeah, for thousands of years prior to the Industrial Revolution, the river provided the means for us to transport goods and materials, and to meet with other neighboring tribes, and to get to where we needed to get to obtain materials for food and shelter, to gather plants, to trap fish and hunt, and to live a very nice way of life. And since the Industrial Revolution, there's been some interruption in that activity due to the building of dams and other impacts to water quality in the river. And we're addressing those, and I think this river restoration project is a great example of what folks can do when we decide to sit down together and to work collaboratively with partners.
Just real quickly, do you want to elaborate a little bit more on some of the other water quality issues? You're speaking of pollution and...
Yeah, there's been pollution issues with the discharge of materials from industry along the river. And, you know, since the Clean Water Act in 1970, there's been standards set, and there's been a tremendous progress since then in cleaning up the river. And we're very happy that we're getting to the point where we're going to be able to restore some fish, you know, 11 species of fish that have been eliminated from the system.
And this is with the dam project?
This is with the dam project, yeah.
So you're obviously working on many issues on the river, but let's talk about the restoration project, what this looks like, what this will involve, and what are the benefits that the tribe hopes to see, and the environmental benefits.
Sure. The River Restoration Project, again, it's designed to restore 11 species of fish back to the Penobscot River system through the removal of two of the lowermost dams in the river. That's the Veazey Dam and the Great Works Dam. The Great Works Dam is in Old Town, and the Veazey Dam is in Veazey. And again, those are the two lowermost dams in the system. Those are the dams that fish, migratory fish coming in, encounter first. And although there has been fish passage in both of these dams that works for some species, just because of the nature of some of the fish species that we're trying to restore, they just don't use the types of fishways. So I think one of the additional great benefits of this project is that while it does take out certain dams, which removes generating capacity, it also restores or maintains a level of energy production by recycling some of the turbines that will be coming out of the dams that are being removed and putting them into other dams on the river system in areas that probably aren't as critical to fish migration. So, you know, this is not only just a fish restoration project, it's very much a energy project as well. You know, we, the tribe, supports, you know, maintaining sources of clean energy, and we think hydro energy isn't a bad way to, you know, to develop energy if it's done in a way that's environmentally friendly and addresses the impacts to the natural resources. And I was in Southern California 2 weeks ago at the National Tribal Environmental Council, And what struck me that week was the discussion on the issues surrounding global climate change. I was really astounded to hear some of the impacts that some of our native brothers and sisters to the north are suffering because of the, you know, the rate at which we as a society are converting coal, oil, and gas, you know, into byproducts, carbon monoxide, and so forth, and putting it into the air, resulting in greenhouse gas formation, and both in terms of the timing and the amount was really quite startling, and the resulting impacts that people are really starting to suffer.
Can you just quickly mention some of those impacts briefly?
Yeah, you know, there was a lot of folks there from up north, from some of the tribes that have practiced a traditional lifestyle for thousands and thousands of years. And, you know, that's being impacted. Polar bears are drowning. They're having to go farther out to sea to hunt seals. And it's just having a tremendous impact on the culture of, you know, some of our native brothers and sisters up north. And so when I think of that and I look at this project, it really does point to the fact that this really is a win-win project, because it provides for the Penobscot Nation to retain some of its cultural integrity, while at the same time producing energy in a way that isn't as harmful to global warming.
Scott, you're the manager of environmental services for the PPL. Now, could you briefly tell us what the PPL is and why the PPL cares to involve itself in a comprehensive solution to look at issues concerning dams, migratory fish, and ecological restoration on the Penobscot River?
Sure. The origin of PPL was actually a utility down in Pennsylvania. It was Pennsylvania Power and Light, and it is now a multinational corporation within which PPL Maine exists. And PPL Maine was established when the corporation purchased all the generating assets from the local utility. That occurred back in 1999, and that really was the time that we were able to be involved with the start of this project and the opportunity to kind of start fresh and give us a chance to talk about all of the issues associated with the hydro dams on the river with all the various parties that have an interest. What we get out of it is as a user of a public resource like the river, we have a series of responsibilities. One of our responsibilities, obviously, is an environmental responsibility to the resource. We also have responsibilities to our shareholders as a business. And really what we tried to do was have a dialogue, establish lines of communication with all of the interested parties, be it state and federal agencies, the Penobscot Indian Nation, environmental groups. And we spent a lot of time, almost 5 years of time, to try to work through all of the issues that we had and come up with, again, what we've described as a win-win situation. And of course, a lot of people will say there really is no such thing as a win-win. But in this instance, as John pointed out, not only are some of the environmental and fish passage issues addressed, from the company's perspective, we can satisfy our responsibilities for those through the restoration agreement. But we also are able to satisfy our responsibilities for our shareholders in a business sense. We get more business certainty in terms of costs. Mm-hmm. We know when and what kind of fishways we'll be constructing. We're already in the process of implementing those now. At the same time, John pointed out that the energy benefits as well. And in fact, as we speak, as a result of the project, we've actually increased our generation. prior to any removals, any purchase of the two or three dams that he mentioned, and then subsequent removal. So as we speak today, we've increased our generation of clean, renewable hydropower as a result of this agreement, and we have the opportunity to replace and recycle generating units and be back in a position where not only have we addressed many of the environmental issues and concerns that folks have had for many, many years in the Penobscot River, but we're also in a position of being able to do that and have the opportunity to not have any kind of a significant impact on the generation that we have today.
So it was the PPL who actually started this whole thing. I heard that you had approached the Penobscot Nation on these dams.
Yeah, what happened is there were actually several of us that worked for the previous owner of the facilities, and so we had a real good understanding. In fact, I've worked with John since the late 80s. So we had a real good understanding of all the issues and the concerns and the questions that have come up over time. And because when PPL came in, that their philosophy was essentially that, look, there's a better way to do business. There's a we kind of coined the phrase, a productive use of capital. Let's try to use our time and energy and resources in a productive way. And in order to do that, it was clear that we had to resolve a bunch of outstanding legal and frankly, philosophical disputes, if you will. And as a result, when PPL Corporation formed PPL Maine and purchased those assets in 99, we recognized that we needed to get people back to the table. We needed to start the dialogue. And we spent probably nearly 2 years talking to each other and understanding everybody's issues. And you know, it's one thing to talk. It's another thing to really listen. And that's what we all tried to do. And I think that was uniform across the board, that all of the parties tried to listen and to really understand what the concerns were. Mm-hmm. You know, for example, we spent a lot of time explaining the difference between electrical capacity and generation. And what mattered to the company in terms of the financial impacts, what mattered to the company in terms of what we felt our responsibilities were. At the same time, John from the Penobscot Nation and Laura from the Trust and other folks were really very patient in explaining why they wanted to do certain things on the river for fish passage purposes, or why they wanted to do it to restore certain species. Mm-hmm. And that was, a long process, but at the same time, it gave us a real good baseline for understanding what we needed to deal with, and then we were able to move forward and figure out creative ways to address them.
I think we're going to talk a little bit more about some of the legal and ecological considerations, but why don't we bring Laura Rose into the conversation as well, the director of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust. Welcome to the program. We have you by phone, Laura.
Thank you. Good morning, Rhonda. Morning, John, Scott.
Good morning.
Good morning.
What specifically are you charged with doing in the trust, and could you tell us about some of this collaboration with state and federal agencies, the environmental groups, industry, and the Penobscot Nation?
Certainly. Well, the Penobscot River Restoration Trust was formed specifically for the purpose of implementing the Penobscot Agreement, which you've been discussing. And there are several organizational members of the trust, as well as some independent board members. The organizations that are involved in the trust include the Atlantic Salmon Federation, American Rivers, Trout Unlimited, the Natural Resources Council of Maine, Maine Audubon, Nature Conservancy. The tribe is also on the board of the trust, and so as you can see, even within the trust, there are a lot of different interests. Yes, they're all conservation groups, but clearly they have very different issues that they focus on, and they also have they come from different backgrounds just within themselves. You know, some are in one Atlantic Salmon Federation is international. Couple are national, couple are state. Some focus on, birds. They have different positions on various kinds of energy enterprises. So, at many different layers, there's collaboration within the Penobscot River Restoration Project. And I have the honor of directing that group and its role in the project. And we're very pleased that PPL Corporation and the tribe and the state and the federal government, each of the state and federal government through more than one agency within. For instance, and the federal government, the Department of Interior, is involved in the project. So is the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Within the Department of Interior, there are several agencies, you know, including the Bureau of Indian Affairs and the Fish and Wildlife Service. So it really, it's a comprehensive project. It addresses a lot of different issues and engages a lot of folks in finding the solution, which is a real strength.
I just want to mention, if anyone in our listening audience has a question, you can call 469-0500 or 1-866-625-WERU. Laura, with every collaboration, there has to be some kind of give and take. What were the compromises that the groups had to make in order to succeed in this agreement?
Well, I think I prefer to think about the deal as it was constructed as the culmination of everyone putting out their preferred, you know, kind of paths to get toward, you know, whether it's maintaining energy or recovering all of the species of fish rather than just some of them, recovering them into the entire system rather than part of the system. I think that we all put out our preferred, you know, kind of best-case scenario, and we worked together to see how far we could get toward that scenario. And I guess in terms of specific compromise, you know, there are the decision to enter into an agreement to purchase the dams was in some ways a compromise because, you know, there's one school of thought, and I'll add that this school of thought could come either from the company or from conservation groups or the tribe, that like the Edwards Dam on the Kennebec, one or more or all of these dams may have at some point been forced off the river because of ecological impacts. On the other hand, the dams, some of them were currently licensed, some of them were not. And really, it was anyone's guess over time, and we could all calculate the odds of achieving our objectives, what would happen if, rather than find a solution that works for everyone, we all decided to just sort of duke it out dam by dam over time. And so the deal that we came to in the long run was a fair purchase of the dams in exchange for really a package that opens up the entire river system to all of these species of fish, restoring 100% of the habitat for half of them, and significant improvements on more than 500 miles for the rest. So, you know, is that a compromise in the scheme of things? You know, I don't know, but I think that that's the kind of thing you're looking for.
Scott, John, do you have anything to add here about the compromises
in the collaboration
specifically? Yes.
Yeah, I mean, I think Laura captured it. If you look at it from a strictly philosophical standpoint, I think she's right. I mean, the company certainly wasn't in a position to want to you know, lose assets, valued assets, for any number of reasons. And certainly when we started, we didn't envision where we ended up, and I think that's probably a fair statement for everybody. And there are bits and pieces here and there that I think people perhaps might view as compromises. At the same time, in the end, for example, in an effort to try to figure out how we could replace the energy, that was very much a collaborative effort. It was, you know, we came up with the physical engineering opportunities and discussed them in a very open and frank way. And we were able to be able to do those things, but at the same time address any environmental issues that came up associated with those in a way that was, you know, wholeheartedly supported by all of the groups. And John mentioned, you know, just the global warming issue to begin with, and that obviously was an important factor for all the parties for any number of reasons. And the end result was the same in a positive way.
John?
Yeah, I think, I think Laura and Scott did a great job summing that question up. But I mean, it was just a great collaboration. And, you know, there was little compromises all along the way. And, you know, that's the nature of collaboration, is that there's, you know, a little bit of give and take. And it took us 3 years to really fully understand, you know, each and every party's interest and objectives with respect to the river. And it's just a great collaboration, and I really think it, you know, sets a precedent. From the tribal standpoint, you know, as a governmental entity, we generally don't formally join up with NGOs and conservation groups. But in this case, you know, the river is so important to the tribe and our culture that we did formally join with these several non-government conservation groups. And that alone, just the nature of that partnership is a great precedent-setting thing. Many tribes across the country are very interested in how we were able to develop this project. And it's just a great example of what can happen when people really want to, you know, look to the future and have a vision of what things should look like down the road, and to realize that there's a better way than just spending all of our resources hiring attorneys to beat each other up in the FERC courts.
We actually, that was our a question that we wanted to lead to, how this was serving as a possible model for other ecological restoration projects, whether they be tribal or not. But this other model for projects with tribes, do you, in the state of Maine or nationally, are you seeing places where this might be able to be replicated in the conversations you've had at this last tribal environmental conference? And
sure. You know, there's a lot of issues out there all across Indian country where tribes are struggling to restore natural resources and to continue to practice their culture by fishing and hunting and so forth. And I guess, you know, an example is the up in northern Washington State at the Makah tribe. They're a whaling tribe, and they, after many, many years of not practicing their culture, they did decide to harvest a whale a few years ago, and there was quite an outcry from many of the environmental groups. And it was ironic. I was out there in Northern California at a meeting with a bunch of tribes, and that same weekend that the macaws were harvesting that whale, there was several of the tribal leaders from that tribe were down in Northern California negotiating with the Coast Guard to have a tugboat established at the mouth of the Sound for purposes of being able to respond to an oil spill. And this was right after the Exxon Valdez oil spill, which, as we know, had a tremendous negative ecological impact for that region. Well, here was the leadership of the Makah tribe using their whaling rights in a way that would provide for a tugboat to be established to be in a position to respond to an oil spill that may happen in the Puget Sound area. So I think people are starting to recognize that tribes in the exercise of their hunting, fishing, and gathering rights can be a big player in conservation and natural resources protection.
We'd like to remind listeners that they can call in with questions or comments toll-free 1-866-625-9378 or locally 469-0500.
Scott, we noted on the Penobscot River Restoration Trust website that the PPL has something to gain from this project, including meeting fish passing requirements, relief from certain relicensing challenges, a higher degree of certainty with respect to post-settlement licensing and costs, and potential development of more efficient energy production at six of your facilities. Can you elaborate on this?
You know, one of the things that we recognized early on was that there was considerable uncertainty, I think, for everybody, all parties, particularly given the way a hydro project is operated and licensed. It's licensed by the state and the federal government, and through a fairly long, drawn-out process, there are a whole host of issues that are addressed, and in that we, Laura had mentioned, there were several of our dams that were already licensed, but there were still outstanding legal disputes that had to be resolved. And your reference to certainty is really where, you know, one of the benefits, obviously, that we see, and frankly, I think it's a benefit for all the parties, is that we're not spending time, you know, in courtrooms and places like that with our time and energy and resources, but we're actually spending them on the river. We're out doing things now. We're working, for example, on installing evaluating, designing, and installing fish passage for eels, for American eels, which didn't exist prior to this agreement. That's one of the things that we focused on. While there are many things that occur over time associated with the settlement agreement, that's one of the ones that we decided that collectively that ought to be done right up front. So we're actually out there doing that today. I think it's probably fair to say that if we hadn't had this agreement, that as Laura pointed out, that we could also still be in, you know, in legal disputes and in regulatory disputes, and maybe nothing else would have happened even to date. But at the same time, now we're in a position collectively and certainly from the company's perspective of, again, satisfying our responsibilities for you know, environmental stewardship as users of the resource, but also satisfying our business responsibilities to our shareholders, and being in a position to do that in a way that you know, we're obviously very proud of, and we expect it. The other benefit really that we've seen is that we are able to continue this, and the relationships that we've developed and the understanding that everybody has collectively of the varied interest allow us to, again, continue in that way in the future. And that's certainly something we're looking forward to.
Are there specific legal requirements then for fish ladders and that sort of thing when you build dams now?
Yes, and in fact, as a result of this agreement, we have this kind of two components. There was the agreement that all the parties signed. Mm-hmm. Within that, there were requirements for us to apply for modifications to our existing licenses, so that not only do we have this kind of contractual business arrangement, if you will, with all the parties, but we also have the legal requirements associated with those arrangements incorporated into our federal licenses. So in other words, there is the teeth behind what we said. We said we're going to do it, and then we included it in our legal requirements. So now, you know, in addition to saying we're going to do it, we're legally required to do it. And, of course, we've always taken the position if we say we're going to do it, we're going to do it. So it didn't concern us at all to have it all incorporated into the legal requirements in the event that, obviously, individuals change and things like that. But that's really how we started implementing the agreement.
We'd like to bring Laura Rose Day back into the conversation, and we'd like to remind listeners again that we're discussing the Penobscot River Restoration Project with our guests, John Banks, the director of the Natural Resources Department at the Penobscot Indian Nation, Scott Hall, manager of environmental services for the energy company PPL, and Laura Rose Day, director of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust. Laura Rose Day, can you clarify the project a little more with us along the lines of a timeline, and what sort of steps are happening when to make this happen, and what then the trust's role is in this?
Sure. The Penobscot Agreement includes an option to purchase three dams on the Penobscot River, and the option is held by the Penobscot River Restoration Trust. Those dams are the VZ and Great Works dams, which are the first two dams on the river, so the closest to the ocean, and then the Howland Dam, which is about 60 miles inland and is important because it sits at the mouth of the Piscataquis River, and there is a lot of very high-value habitat up. You know, these migratory fish spend a good part of their life cycle in the ocean, and then they head up into the river, and depending on the fish, some spawn in the, you know, in the main part of the river, but many of them, such as salmon, go straight up. I mean, absent the dams, they would just literally go, you know, use the river as a highway and go up into streams up at the, you know, at the base of the North Woods. So, so we're talking about the purchase of those three dams, the option period started in June 2004, and it ends in June 2009. And so the timeline for purchase is sometime within the next 3 years, and then there'll be another period of about, you know, a year and a half or 2 years while, you know, removal activities and such go on.
How much money have you raised thus far, and how close are you to your goal?
Well, it's a combination of a number of different sources that we're looking to raise for the project, and we have about $3.5 million in federal money when we're entering another appropriation cycle, and I think it's really notable that that money has been designated for acquisition of the facility, so that's really great. And we started a private campaign just around the beginning of the year, and we will sometime within the next few months announce our private fundraising goal, but we're making very, very good progress in that regard. And we're also looking to state funds at some point, which the state has indicated that they will commit $3 to $5 million toward the project, but that will you know, likely go toward kind of community and economic development types of costs of the project. So we feel really good about where we are. We have about an $8 to $10 million first phase fundraising goal, and we're well on our way to that. Although, as I think you're probably aware, most private fundraising campaigns will make a big splash announcement at some point in that regard.
Can you talk to us specifically about the Atlantic salmon restoration? This is a big issue in the state of Maine, and this is one of the largest projects that seems to be affecting this. Can you talk about that a little more?
Absolutely. You know, the Penobscot Project is one piece of a broader strategy for salmon recovery, and wild Atlantic salmon are on many rivers in Maine protected as a federal endangered species, and so those rivers are the Downeast River and a couple of mid-coast rivers. And salmon are, you know, they're in a lot of trouble. But by the same token, on the Penobscot, there remains a run of salmon that's about 1,000 fish strong. Now, that 1,000 is a remnant of a historic population of between 75,000 and 100,000. So we're still talking about very few fish. But it's widely agreed by fisheries experts that we have a very good probability of bringing salmon back if we take certain actions. The National Academy of Sciences, which includes the best experts on salmon and salmon recovery across the globe, looked at the issue of what does Maine need to do to recover salmon, and they wrote a report in 2004. That report said a number of things, but among the most urgent priorities was consider a strategic program of dam removal. So not all dams, but the dams that open the biggest amount of habitat for salmon, focus on the Penobscot, and do it right away. And they specifically noted this project as being a positive step forward. So this is a very important piece of the overall salmon recovery plan in Maine. And we're really fortunate to have the resources of all of these different entities pushing to make it happen.
John Banks, do you want to comment on specifically the salmon restoration and how that and the other restoration will impact the tribe's sustenance fishing rights?
Sure. You know, during the negotiations for the 1980 Land Claims Settlement Act, there was a lot of discussion about how we would preserve our tribal culture and our fishing rights, and that was a big part of the negotiations. And, you know, I don't believe that the settlement that was reached in 1980 would have been the same if we weren't able to reserve our historic fishing rights within the Penobscot River because of the, you know, the importance of that activity to our traditions and culture. Salmon is, you know, one species. It gets a lot of attention, but a lot of the impacts to the salmon population are based on problems with the habitat. You know, we've always maintained and have tried to convince federal and state fisheries agencies that if you want to restore salmon, you know, restore the river, restore the habitat, bring back the native assemblage of fish that existed prior to the demise of the river. And, you know, rather than just focusing solely on Atlantic salmon, restore the river. And, you know, that will provide the foundation for the food chain that, you know, that makes it possible for the salmon to have a nice place to come back to.
Yep.
And, Rhonda, you know, unlike sometimes people think about salmon as in the Pacific Northwest.
But I guess we don't.
Sorry,
go ahead, Laura.
Oh, no, that's okay. Where salmon, when people think about, you know, kind of biomass of fish, you know, the amount of fish that come into the inland system, salmon really drive the systems out in the Pacific Northwest. And here, as John points out, salmon are very important, but in terms of numbers, the fish that were abundant in the greatest numbers were herring, you know, alewives and blueback herring and American shad, and all of these fish together formed a really healthy ecosystem, not just in the river, of course, but the river connects with, you know, inland streams and ponds on in the interior, and also all of these fish, you know, spend time in the ocean and were important sources of food for even ground fish, which are also in trouble now. So it's really, I mean, the people who need to be involved in recovering the river are all connected as the ecosystem itself. All the components are really connected and depend on one another.
Scott, I know that your corporation owns other hydropower entities in various states. After this project is over, is the PPL planning to replicate this project elsewhere?
Well, I guess, first of all, just in perhaps a little bit of a response to your question, I'm not sure that this project will ever be over. It's kind of a dynamic process that will continue, and we certainly expect and hope that it'll continue for many years to come. PPL Corporation does own other hydro assets in Pennsylvania and Montana in particular. The specifics on a river with a species of fish, with energy production, they're all very, very different. The unique circumstances presented in the Penobscot aren't really replicated everywhere else or anywhere else. However, that being said, certainly PPL Corporation will thoroughly understands its responsibilities, takes them very seriously, and actively works here and in Pennsylvania and in Montana and frankly around the globe to satisfy those responsibilities, and particularly in terms of the environmental resources that our facilities impact and that we use and take advantage of. So in the sense of continuing to foster dialogue, to work with all the interested parties, and to satisfy those responsibilities, in any way, shape, or form, that is something that is kind of a company philosophy that will certainly continue in the future, and be applied to hydro or other resources within our generation base.
Are you currently doing anything else in the other states that is similar to what you're doing now with the state of Maine, or is this the first PPL has kind of launched?
Timing-wise, I don't know about first or second, but certainly out in Montana, for example, they have a comprehensive river system plan that they've instituted on the Madison and Missouri rivers. Many of the same kinds of parties are involved. There are some Native American interests. There are state and federal resource agencies. There are, you know, varying environmental issues. Some of the dams out there obviously are considerably bigger and higher, being out in the mountains. At the same time, they have, some of the native trout, which are much more of an interest there. They do habitat restoration projects. There are many, many similarities, particularly in terms of philosophy. And obviously the specifics are a little different. They don't have Atlantic salmon in Montana. But too bad. But the issues are certainly very, very similar. And again, the philosophy and the intent and the interest on the behalf of the corporation is very much the same.
John Banks, other threads you want to bring into this, the whole issue that maybe we haven't touched on, or other ways you want to elaborate the tribe's role in this project?
Well, the tribe's role, this really started from kind of an outgrowth of the Basin Mills project. The tribe had developed a good working relationship with several of the entities involved in the Basin Mills project. And from there, we continued that relationship. And then, as Scott said earlier, when PP&L took over these projects, it just really provided a great opportunity for us all to work together.
Could you explain the Basin Mills project to us? Because I'm not sure if our listening audience knows about it.
Well, the Basin Mills was a proposal to build a new dam at Basin Mills Rips, which is in the Orono area. It's just downstream from where the Stillwater Branch re-enters the Penobscot River. And that project would have inundated the last free-flowing stretch of river between us and the ocean. And I think there was a great effort to defeat that, the building of that dam. But, out of that effort grew a collaboration between the tribe and some of the environmental groups. And that was it.
Mm-hmm. But continue on your thoughts then about the...
Yeah, so, like Scott said, when PP&L took over the dams from the previous owner, it provided a real opportunity to kind of start from scratch and to really work collaboratively to find a better way. During the Basin Mills debate, there was some discussion about, if we're going to build a new dam, a new modern dam that could perhaps have better fish passage than some of the old dams, then let's talk about removing, some of the old dams if we're going to build a new one. And so those discussions had continued right up until the time that the licenses were issued. And building of the new dam at Basin Mills was denied by FERC.
Great.
We do want to touch on the fact, John Banks, that you were just the recipient of the Michael A. Frost Award that was presented at the National Tribal Environmental Council just earlier this month, was it? You've been the director there since 1980, was the first person to be the director of the Department of Natural Resources. Can you just talk a little bit about what that award is and what the National Tribal Environmental Council is? We do want to recognize that
sure,
happened.
Sure, thank you. Yeah, the National Tribal Environmental Council is a national organization of about roughly 180 federally recognized tribes that work together to address national environmental issues right down from the grassroots kind of technical stuff all the way up to the policy level in Washington, D.C. It was incorporated in 1992, and the Penobscot Nation was actually one of the seven founding tribes of NTEC. Our tribal chief, James Sapier, is currently the president of NTEC. And there was a guy named Michael Frost, who's a he was a Southern Ute Indian that had been one of the original board members of NTEC, and I worked with him back then. And he was also a member of EPA's Tribal Operations Committee, which I was a member of as well from 1994 to 2000. And I worked very closely with Mike on many of these national tribal environmental issues. And so for me to receive that award from the tribal leadership of 180 tribes was really very special, and it's really an honor.
Indeed, your department has been quite progressive on environmental issues.
Well, you know, absolutely. You know, as a manager, we have to realize that, you know, 98% of the battle is having good people working with us. So I really have to, you know, hand it to our staff at the Department of Natural Resources. They're just a great bunch of dedicated folks, and they really deserve this award because a skipper without a crew isn't can't do very much, and we just have a great crew that works with us, and I really have to hand it to them.
Great, and work that has been for the tribe, but also you often are reaching out beyond the tribe to work with state agencies and other organizations, and this current project is a yet another manifestation of that.
Yeah. You know, when we made the announcement for the conceptual agreement a couple of years ago, there was over 500 newspapers that picked it up, and including the largest daily in the country of Japan. I guess over in Japan, they're having similar issues of, you know, how to address environmental concerns with the relicensing of hydro dams. And so this, you know, this really does have some international flavor to it.
Speaking of national, there's a national conference next week in Bar Harbor. John, could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's the National Conference of the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society, which is another national tribal organization that focuses more on fish and wildlife issues. We held this same conference back in 1991, and back then it was real special because that conference commemorated the coming together of all the tribes nationally to make that a true national organization. And we had a really special ceremony. There was some of our friends from tribes in the Pacific Northwest brought a bunch of water from the Pacific Ocean, and we mixed it with water in the Atlantic Ocean, and we had a great ceremony, which again was, you know, commemorated the coming together of all the tribes to work collaboratively on fish and wildlife issues. And so we're hosting that again 15 years later at the exact same place. So we really look forward to that.
And what are some of the issues that will be touched on then there?
Well, there'll be presentations from tribes all across the country on various issues that they're working on. There will be a segment on the Penobscot River Restoration Project. Myself and Gordon Russell from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service will be discussing that project. And it really just covers the whole gamut of tribal fish and wildlife issues, both at the technical level and at the policy level. Mm-hmm. So it's really, I think the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society is a little more of a grassroots group. There's a lot of fish and wildlife biologist types and conservation rangers that get together and talk about what's working and what's not working, and it provides a great forum to exchange, you know, technical information on certain fish and wildlife practices.
Will it just be tribal agencies involved, or are there others involved?
No, there's others. You know, we work with federal and state agencies. There'll be a lot of participation from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and I think the Maine Warden Service will be there. And there'll be other, you know, other groups as well, just besides other than tribes.
Well, I think we're winding down here, so I'd like to get some last words from everyone and find out more about if you have anything to add about the work that you're doing and where do you go from here.
One thing I did want to add, John actually made a good point when he was talking about his well-deserved national award about the other people involved, and I'm certainly not going to try to thank everybody that was involved or recognize everybody, but it really was an awful lot of people, you know, representing each of the individual interests that worked, you know, many, many hours and months and years, frankly, to get us to the point where we could actually, again, be productive on the river for everybody's interest. And so I do want to make sure that everybody, you know, listening understands that there were a lot of people involved. There was a lot of patience and determination, I think, and that starts from, you know, the top of the company, All the way down to those of us in Maine, and the same thing with all the various interests in the government agencies as well as the tribe. For our standpoint, we're certainly looking forward to continuing to work together to implement the agreement and kind of seeing the results and the benefits that we're already seeing, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of energy, for example. And we look forward to continuing those in the future.
Laura, do you have any last words you'd like to add?
Well, really just to echo what Scott has said, you know, we've made a tremendous amount of progress just having reached such an agreement to restore an entire river ecosystem is a huge accomplishment, but there's a lot of work still to be done, and we look forward to working with everyone to make sure that someday the project is fully implemented and the river recovered.
Just quickly, because we do have a couple more minutes, what is that more work that you're seeing that needs to be done, Laura?
Well, we need to complete the fundraising. In particular, we have a big push on federal fundraising at this point, so there are a lot of folks who support that effort. There will be the dam removal process itself, and, it's the agreement is about an inch and a half thick, and Scott referred to the fact that there are a lot of fish passage requirements and many, many components that it'll continue to take a lot of work to get it all done. So, we believe that we'll continue to see the same kind of energy toward implementing the project as we've seen toward actually reaching the agreement. And a significant infusion of federal funds to meet the obligations of fish passage and making sure that they're fishing the river to meet the tribe's fishery rights will be, I think, a very good investment.
John Banks.
Yeah, this project for me just really represents a great sense of hope for the future. You know, the Penobscot Nation's been in this area since the Ice Age for, 10 or 12,000 years, and it's only been recently, within the past couple of hundred years, where there's been, some ecological damages to the river that have, impacted our culture and traditions. And just the fact, as Laura said, the fact that we were able to sit down with such a diverse group of folks that were all really interested in looking at a future that meets everybody's needs. I mean, the river is a great resource, and it's, provided and met our needs for thousands and thousands of years. And it continues to meet the needs of society today. And, the process that we went through to arrive at this cooperative vision of the future just really gives me a great sense of hope for the future. The tribe often feels that it's, fighting a great uphill battle to address some of the major impacts to our resources. And just the fact that we were able to sit down and come to a consensus, I think, gives me a great sense of hope for the future.
Great. Thank you. You can find more information about this project on penobscotriver.org or information on the tribe's proceedings, penobscotnation.org. We'd like to thank our guests, John Banks, Director of the Natural Resources Department at the Penobscot Indian Nation, Scott Hall, Manager of the Environmental Services for the PPL, and Laura Rose Day, Director of the Penobscot River Restoration Trust.
Thank you, Rhonda.
Thank you, Laura. You've been listening to Indigenous Voices, a monthly talk show discussing topics affecting the Native people of Maine with Rhonda Fry and Meredith DeFrancesco.
Indigenous Voices can be heard every third Tuesday of the month. The theme song is Circle of Friendship by Joanne Shenandoah. Amy Brown engineered today's program. Join us again next month for Indigenous Voices.
Thank you.